Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcorn with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, school is the place I was forced to show up in between learning things. I've always been a reader, but as a kid, I actually found it so hard to stop reading that I once crashed into a parked car while reading on my bicycle. So once I figured out the game of school, which seemed to be getting good grades, I figured out how to do that while doing as little as possible in school. You could say that grades killed learning for me, in school at least, and it turns out that the reward systems we have for kids and in a whole lot of areas of our lives are actually counterproductive and even damaging in terms of motivating what we think we're motivating. To discuss what decades of research say about how we're actually motivated, I have a very special guest tonight, psychologist Dr. Edward L. Deci, co-author with Richard Flast of Why We Do What We Do, Understanding Self-Motivation. Dr. Deci, along with his research collaborator, clinical psychologist Dr. Richard Ryan, has found that self-motivation is actually at the heart of creativity, responsibility, healthy behavior, and the lasting change. On tonight's show, Dr. Deci will debunk widely held and counterproductive myths about motivation and explain the nuances of how we can motivate ourselves and encourage others to successfully motivate themselves, too. Hello, Edward.
Hi, Amy. This is great. I'm happy to be here. I don't get a chance to talk to a goddess very often.
self-named. I'm thrilled you're here. Your book, as I told you before the show, Why We Do What We Do, was one of the books that was most inspiring to me of all the psychology books I've read, right up there with Man's Search for Meaning by the concentration camp survivor, whose name I'm going to forget right now. Viktor Frankl. Thank you. Did you want to say something about him?
No, just the Viktor Frankl. It was a wonderful book.
Really wonderful book. And so this inspired me the same way, because you talk about a lot of issues that are near and dear to me, like personal responsibility and autonomy, and we'll get into those. But I just wanted to sort of get to the one of the nuts of your research, that people are moved by these external factors, like a desire to get a grade or have others think well of them, but you find that the strongest motivation comes from within.
Yeah, that's true. You know, most people, when they think about motivation, the first thing that comes to their mind are rewards. Pay them to do it. Use some kind of external factor to get people to do it. And it is true, actually, that we can, if we have enough money and there's something we want somebody else to do, we can probably get them to do it. But that's a motivation of a certain sort. The thing that, in order to really understand it, we have to do is distinguish between different kinds of motivation. So let me just very quickly and very simply say, there are two very different kinds of motivation that exist within people, and we use the terms autonomous motivation and controlled motivation to refer to those. Controlled motivation is kind of like what has often been talked about as the carrot and stick. We motivate people by dangling carrots in front of them or standing behind them with sticks. And if the carrot's big enough and they're hungry enough, they'll move to get it. And if you've got a big stick behind them and are threatening them, they'll probably move to get away from that stick. It is possible to motivate people in ways that have to do with rewards and punishments. But the problem is, what many economists who advocate that, and even many psychologists who advocate it, don't recognize is that there are a whole host of negative consequences that follow from that. When people get caught up in following rewards or running to avoid punishments, a set of psychological processes go on in them in which they lose a sense of who they really are and come to see themselves as simply these donkeys being enticed or coerced through a reward and punishment system. In contrast to the controlled type of motivation is what we call autonomous motivation. Is it the case that you ever have a time in your life when you feel free to do whatever you want to do? Maybe you really love to read books, to play the piano, to play golf. There are lots of things. Different people like different kinds of things, but when people are feeling really free from demands and constraints, they do the things they love to do, the things they find interesting and enjoyable.
Now, I
you
want to get
don't
into
have to try and motivate them to do those things. All the motivation for doing the things that we find interesting and enjoyable exists within us. And when we're motivated in those ways, the quality of the performance, as well as our own sense of feelings about ourselves, is much more positive.
Well, I want to backtrack a little bit and then talk about autonomy, but first, you know, you talk about in your book how there are a lot of problems of irresponsibility in our culture, and many people think the answer is tightening control, but you say
right. That
that's an easy answer, that it works temporarily, but it ultimately makes problems worse. And this is because it is so important for us. It is so important to who we are to be autonomous. And so explain a little bit, if you can just give us a brief explanation of what autonomy is.
Yeah. Autonomy refers to doing some activity with the experience of volition, willingness, and choice. If you're doing something and you can say to yourself, at this moment, I truly choose to be doing this. I concur with the fact that I'm doing this. If you can come to that place at any given moment, you will be acting autonomously. You will be acting in a way that is what I think of as being really psychologically free. I do this out of a true sense of willingness and desire. That's what autonomous motivation is about, and one of the best examples of it is a little child. Look at a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old. They spend their time playing, and when they're playing, they're doing it with a full sense of presence, of willingness, of desire. They love what they're doing. They find it enjoyable, and they'll go on forever doing it. That's an example of being autonomously motivated.
You use the word authenticity, and this word. It sort of makes me sick now because people use it in a very woo-woo way. But this is what you're talking about with a 2-year-old. There isn't an inauthentic 2-year-old out there. They're just doing what
right.
they want to do. And you talk about a different kind of behavior, which is control behavior.
Right.
And there are two kinds you talk about. There's compliance and defiance. So first tell us what compliance is. And you say that's what authoritarian solutions help to accomplish.
Okay, so this sense of autonomous motivation in these kids playing, for instance, or you when you go golfing or whatever are the things that you love to do, those things you're doing with a full sense of willingness, and it's coming out of you. But the other type of motivation involves someone else in the world pressuring you to do something, trying to get you to do something. So parents offer kids rewards for doing things, or they threaten them with punishments for doing things, and so do bosses, and so do teachers sometimes, and so forth. So here we've got motivation that's coming from the outside. When that happens to you, when people are trying to pressure you into doing something, you can be respond in one of two ways. Well, there's more than two, but I'll talk about two. One is you can buckle under and do it. The authority told me to do it, and I'm going to do what the authority says because that's what I'm supposed to do. That's compliance. When you're complying to an authority because the authority told you to do it, then you're being controlled. That's not you making a choice. That's you being forced by someone else. So that's compliance. Sometimes, however, when the pressures and controls get great, you've just had enough, and you'll be darned if you're going to be doing any more of this. So you rebel. You react against it, and you defy the authority. So what you do now is not necessarily what you want to do, but it's what you're doing because you're trying to prove something to the authority. You can't get away with this with me. I'll just defy you. The thing, interesting thing is, those are the opposite behaviors that you'd be doing. If you comply, you do what the authority wants you to because the authority wants you to. If you defy, you're doing the opposite of what the authority wants you to because the authority wants you to. In both cases, interestingly, you're being controlled by that authority. You're not coming to a point of making a true choice for yourself, knowing what's right for you and making the decision to do that.
And now, very interestingly, you also talk about how people can be controlled without their even knowing it. You talk about people having these internalized, they've internalized the controls from society or whoever the authority figure is, whether it's their parent or their teacher, and then they respond compliantly without even realizing they're doing it.
That's exactly right. And let me give you a kind of example of how this works. One of the ways that parents use to try and socialize their children is what we call conditional regard. Parents will be conveying, it's not that they say this out loud to their kids, but well, some maybe do, but one way or another they convey to the child, I will love you if you do what I want you to do and be the person I want you to be, and I won't love you if you don't. That's conditional regard or conditional love, if you prefer that. That's an amazing way to get children to do things. I mean, kids will do things if they believe their parents' love is contingent upon their doing those things. Okay.
But that
so we get
a
control.
Love.
Yeah. So we get controlled by our parents.
Wait, let me just stop you and ask you. That doesn't develop any sort of love for what they're doing. They're maybe not even focusing on that. They're just chasing the love of the parent.
Exactly. You're exactly right about that. But the interesting thing that happens is, then they tend to internalize those contingencies, take them into themselves, and they start doing to themselves what their parents initially did to them. So now, if my mother had said to me, Ed, I'll love you if you do X, Y, and Z, and I won't love you if you don't, I did it to get her love. But as I grow a little more, I begin to take that in, and now I'm essentially saying to myself, Ed, I will love you if you do this, and I won't love you if you don't. Now, of course, I don't say it in that way. The psychological way of talking about that is contingent self-esteem. My feeling of worth as a person becomes dependent on those kinds of things. So now I'm essentially from the inside pushing myself around. I'm trying to make myself lose weight or study harder for an exam or whatever it is, because I have this internal contingency that says, I won't feel like a worthy person unless I do it. That's what we are referring to by this kind of internal control, in which we push ourselves around not realizing exactly what it is that we're doing.
Yeah, I think it's so important to point out, because by pointing it out, we can maybe notice it in ourselves. We're going to come back and talk about choice as the key to self-determination and authenticity, but first, I'm going to do a little station break. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is psychologist Edward L. DC, co-author with Richard Flast of Why We Do What We Do, Understanding Self-Motivation. And this is a book based in large part on DC's research collaborations with psychologist Richard Ryan. So we want to give everyone credit. So choice. So talk about choice as the key to self-determination and authenticity.
Yeah. You know, we have a life. All of us have a life in front of us. And at every moment in that life, there are choices we can make. You can decide, you can choose to do this or to do that, to eat this or to do that, and so on. And there's the possibility of really making that choice, of coming to know what is the right thing for you to be doing in this moment. That's what choice means. It means doing the thing that's the right thing for you to be doing in this moment.
Now, let me just ask you, doesn't this require, for you to decide that, you have to have some knowledge of yourself, and if you behave this way where you're chasing your parents' love and everything, I mean, I think that that's some homework that a lot of people need to do to even get to the point of being able to determine what their choices are.
I think that's absolutely right. I think this whole idea of being responsible for yourself requires knowing yourself. But you know what? There's nothing in the world that's more interesting than you are. If you, whoever you are out there, and hello to you, if you really get down to it, you realize that your own inner life is just about the most interesting thing there is. And so my point of view is always take interest in that inner life. There's so much to learn about yourself and about the world by paying attention of what's going on inside. And it's through self-knowledge, really, that we gain the freedom to live our lives in authentic and meaningful and satisfying ways. That's what I'm really interested in the most, that people are living in a way that is truly and genuinely satisfying, and knowing what's really interesting to them and knowing what's truly valuable for them is really the basis for acting responsibly in life.
Well, I think this point you made, that some people may have developed internal controls that stem from others, that this mm-hmm. really suggests that people may need to experiment and fail in various ways to get a sense of who they are. And I think it's really important for people to look at themselves and see if what you said, if they are internally controlled by forces that didn't come from within, from who they are, that they can start to experiment and change that.
Yes, so imagine now a situation. Really, often it's the case that there are conversations going on in our heads, and maybe we don't pay close attention to them. We sort of push them off to the side. But lots of times the form that those conversations take is that there's one part of you that's saying, you must do X. Well, you don't like to be told what you must do. You didn't like it when your parents did it to you. You didn't like it when your boss does it to you. You don't like it when your doctor does it to you. And you don't like it when you do it to yourself, when some voice in your head does it to you. I would suggest that the next time you hear that voice in your head, you just say, no, I don't. I don't have to do what you're telling me to do. I can take the time and space to think about this for myself. So why don't you just shut up and let me decide what it is I need to do for myself? You've got to, in some sense, sort of stand up to that voice that you've taken in from the world that's telling you what you should do and what you must do, and realize that you don't have to do that. And you're a perfectly worthy person whether you do it or not.
Yeah, I think that's very important. And this idea, we're so influenced, we're so outcome-oriented. And I think that you seem to argue against that.
Yeah, I do, you know, in part because a lot of the outcomes that we put so much focus on are not outcomes that have real meaning to myself. I mean, I look at the whole thing that's going on in the education world of the United States at this point, and brought on by by federal agencies and by the last couple of presidents that we've had, one from each party, in which there's this big emphasis on education, and there's nobody who's more in favor of education than me, mind you, but all the attention gets put on grades on standardized tests that are given by the, administered by the various states. And the whole notion is achievement score, achievement score, achievement score. And there's no attention paid to what it is that schools really, in my opinion, should be about. They should be about facilitating learning, not necessarily just the kinds of things that go on these achievement tests. They should be about a deeper kind of learning that lets you understand concepts, a deeper kind of learning that lets you understand the value of other people in the world so that you have respect for them as well as yourself.
Now, I just want to backtrack a little, because I want people to understand what's behind this. You've done research in this. There's been a great deal of research in addition to your research that shows why what you're talking about with education, why it's so important that we not be so grade and reward focused. And I guess I'll start out with you described the seals at Prospect Park in the zoo. And they do all sorts of tricks, like clapping their flippers together in order to get fed by people watching them. But as soon as the people feeding them disappear or stop feeding them, the entertaining behaviors disappear. And you found the same thing when you tested students. You pay them to get to an outcome, or you tell them, look, you'll be – there was one study I think you did where you said, look, you're going to be having to teach other people these concepts. And tell us about that one.
There are a whole set of them, and they take different forms. But the first thing, the first study takes the form that, imagine you're doing something that's really interesting to you, a puzzle to solve or something else, whatever it is, but something that's really interesting to you. It turns out that if you're doing something that's really interesting, and then I come along and say, I would like you to do that activity there, the one that you were interested in, and because I'd like you to do it, I'm going to pay you to do it. So now you start to do some activity that you find really interesting and internally motivating, something you enjoy, and you're going to get paid for doing it. You would think that's the best of both worlds, wouldn't you? But the interesting thing is that once people started getting paid to do something that was interesting, they stopped finding it interesting. They shifted their relationship to that task from something that I do this because it's interesting to now I do this because it's something that will get me paid. And when they do that, they no longer have that relationship with the task in which they're truly engaged and involved with it. These external rewards, for instance, in this case, the money that I was talking about, actually come to control people's behavior. And once their behavior becomes controlled by it, the activities that they initially liked come to be not any longer interesting. They become simply instrumental to getting some kind of reward. So they lose their own sense of internal motivation for it. in that example that you were and the experiment that you were asking about, we did that where did a similar thing in which for some of the people we asked them to learn some very kind of complex material, and we said, we're going to give you a test on this. So learn the material so that you can take a test and do well on it. That goes on in schools all over the country all the time, in elementary schools, in medical schools, wherever you want to look in schools, you'll find that kind of thing where people are saying you should learn this in order to be able to do well on a test. We took the other half of the people who were involved in this experiment and we said, here's this material and we'd like you to learn it. And when you come back to the lab in next week after you've had time to learn this material, we're going to have you teach the material to someone else. Now, right here, we've provided people an opportunity to take some learning that they're doing and put it into active use, to act on the world with respect to it, not just to be tested by some authority figure, but actually to do something for someone else that involves that material. And what happened is those people who were learning it in order to use it in some future activity actually found the material more interesting, and they learned it in such a way that they we actually gave them a test on it, which they didn't expect. They did much better on the test than the people who learned it in order to take the test, because they learned it in a deep way with the anticipation of putting it into use in the world. If we could do much more of getting people involved with activities because they have some relevance and meaning in their lives and because they're going to be using it in some active way, I think we'd get a much deeper kind of learning than the memorization that goes on the night before a test.
Yeah, and this is such a huge motivator, being able to make a difference. And I mentioned Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, and he talks about how the way we have meaning in our lives is not by chasing happiness, but by trying to do things for other people. And that sounds like some kind of like socialist claptrap, but it's really not, because it affects us, because we are motivated. We ourselves, through who we are, have made a difference in other people's lives. And,
right.
And just to comment further on the education example, Peter Gray, do you know Peter Gray's research about the Sudbury School, where they have no grades and students just study what they want? Do you know about that
only
school?
Vaguely.
Well, I've had a developmental psychologist criticize me. I had him on my show, and he said, oh, there's not enough rigorous research behind his work. But really, I find, and I thought when I had him on the show, that there's so much support. The stuff that you're talking about, I had read your work before, and Carol Dweck and other people who have done work that supported what you've found, that's found the same things, that this people being cultivating a love of learning, as opposed to what I was taught to cultivate, which is, just, you know, how can I get those A's with the least amount of work? I mean, I did not go even near an AP classroom in high school because I figured out I could get into the University of Michigan by just getting A's and all the easy, like, just regular history, not AP history. But, you know, and I'm a person who loves learning, but I just, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to learn what I want to learn. This is exactly what I did. I read all these books, Russian literature and complicated stuff in science, but I just wasn't having it assigned to me what somebody else thought was interesting or important. Mm-hmm. And your research really argues for that, for kids, for us not being so nervous. And Peter Gray insists that these kids, yes, they go to college, they know how to do math, they do better than other kids in college, they don't feel that they're behind in some ways. But it's sort of scary because we like this idea, we like to feel we're controlling things. But you talk about how control is actually, it's so damaging to motivating people.
Right. That's just exactly right. That, you know, if you think about people, and we've been doing research on this for decades, there are certain kinds of things that people need to live a healthy life. There are some physiological things. You need oxygen in order to live a healthy life. You need water in order to live a healthy life. There are certain kinds of physiological needs that are essential for you to be healthy. And pretty much everybody agrees with that. I've never heard anybody argue against that. But what we say is your mind, your psyche, also has some needs, some essential nutrients in order for you to be psychologically healthy. And two of the most important of those needs are the need for relatedness. In other words, you need to be related to other people in the world. You can't live on an island by yourself forever and be psychologically healthy. I mean, of course, you can spend time alone. That's a wonderful thing to do. But fundamentally, you need to have a sense of involvement with other people to be tied into some collective that's larger than you. And that might only be a nuclear family of four people, whatever it is, but still we have this fundamental need for relatedness, and if it's not satisfied, then there will be negative psychological consequences that follow from it. But we also need to feel a sense of autonomy. These two needs go hand in hand, and each supports the other. Autonomy is the sense of being in a place of believing the motivation for what I'm doing right now comes from deep within me, and that this is the activity I need to be doing at this moment. So we've got autonomy, and we've got relatedness, and they go together. And the relatedness is really important because that's what allows us to be able to accept responsibility for living in the world in a cooperative kind of way. There's a world here. There are a lot of people, billions of people on this earth, and we need to be able to relate to those other people in order to have a world that's more harmonious. The fundamental need is within us, if it doesn't get screwed up, to be relating to other people. But we get that screwed up in all kinds of ways, and then we don't follow through with what we need and behave in aggressive and unpleasant kind of ways that go against our very nature. Our very nature is to do what's right for us, and to come to the place that's what's right for us is also right for people more generally.
And I want to get back to that because that's a very important issue. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is psychologist Dr. Edward L. Deci. He's co-author with Richard Flast of Why We Do What We Do, Understanding Self-Motivation. And this book is based in good part on Deci's research collaborations with psychologist Dr. Richard Ryan. So I wanted to get back to choices. We think that controlling people is a way to get them to do things. But you talk about how this diminishes their feelings of self-determination, but giving them choices about how to behave is much healthier, and we can actually do this in small ways, just by giving them, for example, a choice, as you give in the book, an example of a friend's aunt who wasn't taking her medication, and what helped her take it was a doctor who said, you know, what time of day did she think would be best for her to take it? And she said at bedtime. And I mean, just these sorts of little choices seem to really hit us in the right spot in our psyche where we can feel like we have autonomy and we're not just being controlled like puppets.
Exactly. That is the case. And, you know, people sometimes say, teachers say, oh, I don't have enough time to give students choices about things. They just have to do what they have to do. Or managers say that. There are very, very, very few instances in the world where it really is the case that you cannot allow people to make choices. It doesn't have to be big choices. I mean, and all of our choices get made within constraints. We all live with certain constraints that exist in the world by our very nature. I can't walk through a wall. That's a constraint that exists for me. Now, that's a silly thing to say, but there are other kinds of constraints that exist also. So we make choices, but those choices exist within limits or within constraints. And what we need to do as parents or teachers or physicians is both to be clear about what the constraints are, and then within those to allow as much choice as we possibly can. And by allowing that choice, that gives the people that we're working with, the child, the student, the patient, gives them a greater sense of autonomy, a greater sense that they actually are in charge of themselves. And with that comes much more motivation to do the activity, whatever it is, take the medicine, do your homework, and so on.
We'll get to that with both kids and relationships, which we discussed talking about close relationships. But I just wanted to give a little example of this. You know, you were saying about the small ways you can give people choice. I think I've mentioned this on the show before. I have a part-time editorial assistant who works for me. And when I first read this research about choice and how important it was, I started to ask her, would you rather go through my notes now or would you rather edit a question? And that's the kind of tiny choice you can give someone. Just give them control over their own life in the smallest ways. I'm not saying, okay, well, what do you want to do? And her answer might be, well, I want to go drink a beer. But that's not an option. Yeah. So I'm giving her limits, but within the limits, I'm letting her make a choice. So it's that simple, you know, not just to tell people, bring down the hammer and say, do this right now. You know, and so you can just look for those options.
You know, limits are very important. We're not talking here when I'm talking about supporting our children's freedom or autonomy or volition. I'm not talking about let them do anything they want to do. It would not be okay with me if I had a kid who threw a brick through my window or, you know, who broke something that was really special to me just for the heck of it, you know. That's not okay, and we've got to live in a world where we pay attention to the fact that there are limits out there. What we're really trying to do with our parents and our students is to teach them that there are limits in the world and that you ultimately can make a choice about whether to live within them or not. But you have to realize that whether you choose to live within the limit or to transgress the limit, there are certain consequences associated with it. That's the nature of life. Our life is about making decisions and dealing with the consequences that result from it. And I want you, my student, my child, whoever, to understand that, so that you can come to the place of making decisions in a responsible way.
So, but tell us the nuts and bolts of that. How do parents administer consequences or give limits while still being supportive of their kids' autonomy? Because it really is just easier to bring down the hammer.
Yeah. Well, see, the problem is that all too often when parents are setting limits, for instance, they're in a stressed place. They're upset with their kids about something maybe, or maybe it's a lot of pressure that went on for them during the day at work or whatever it happens to be, or they've got to hurry up or they're going to miss their plane or whatever it is. Okay. So parents are very often stressed when they're dealing with their children, and when they're in a stressed place, the thing they do is what you said, bring down the hammer. It's like, we've got to get this done. Now, come on. But in fact, really, the important thing is to convey to the child, here are the limits that exist. And it's important for various reasons to live within those limits. and then you give the rationale, whatever it is, whatever the importance of it is. Now, of course, the child has the choice to live within those limits or to transgress them. But you also have to understand that when you transgress them, there are certain consequences that will be associated with that. You can, as a parent, do that. You can do that if you're in a place where you're not too stressed to do it. Usually, we're in a place where we're stressed, and it's hard to get to the place of relating to the child in that way. And I know that that's true, and we all get to that place, and so we do things that are not optimal. The best thing I can say about that is, tomorrow, let's sit down with the kids or the students, whoever it is, and have a little conversation about what went on yesterday. We got a chance to learn from what happened yesterday when I got all stressed and upset and pushed on you, my student, my child, whatever, and yelled at you or made you do something. We can be talking about it, and we can each be learning something from it so that we get to the place where we're setting limits in a more rational way and not in a way where it's all coming out of anger and upset and stress.
Yeah, I think that's very important to wait till the steam comes down and to really reflect on what's going on, because it's so hard to see that in the moment. And I wanted to touch on something else, too. We've been talking about your authentic self and autonomy. Now, my authentic self does not live to take out the garbage, but you talk in your book about internalization. I think we mentioned that once before. And this is where, in terms of a kid transforms something asked of him as something that he does as a matter of course. And you talk about taking out the garbage, that he does that as part of relating to others. It's not really the garbage part of it that's exciting.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not very excited about taking out garbage. On the other hand, I don't want garbage around my house. And if I'm living in my house with some other people, with children, with my parents, or whoever it happens to be, we have this house here. We live in it together. We work together to keep the house a place where it's a safe and secure and pleasant and enjoyable place to be spending our lives. And there's some things that have to be done in order for us to be here together effectively. And amongst those things is taking out the garbage. Now, I would like for you, my son, for instance, to be willing to help out with this. You might take out the garbage some days. I might take it out some days. You might do this, and I might do that, and so on. That it's a way that collectives, that families, that groups, whatever the groups are, can function effectively with each other. We come, each one of us, to the place of accepting the responsibility of taking our share of what it is that's necessary in order to keep things moving smoothly in our home.
So I would say what you're talking about is, it's talking about, this is our family culture, you're part of this, and so it's not some horrible task. And I've seen this actually with parents who had their other kids look after their autistic child, not as some chore, it was just what you do if you're in this family, that everyone looks after their child. And this seems to be a similar thing. And just that it becomes part of somebody rather than some kind of thing that's a control.
Exactly.
So I want to move on. You said that you didn't put in close relationships in your book, and I am talking with Dr. Edward Aldisi. His book is Why We Do What We Do, Understanding Self-Motivation. I should say just about everything else is in it, including a lot of stuff that I loved about freedom and personal responsibility and where the two meet. So you've been working on research in relation to close relationships, romantic relationships. Tell us something about that.
Okay. So I will say that in the book, most of what's discussed in the book involves multiple people. So I'll just say two as an example. And there's, in that relationship, pretty much always in the examples and in the discussion, an authority relationship that exists. Parent-child, teacher-student, physician-patient, coach-athlete, and so on. Always these authority relationships. And a lot of what we discuss in the book is about the authority figure and how he or she can relate to the others, the children, the athletes, the patients, in a way that facilitates effective functioning and psychological health in those others. When it comes to close relationships, it's a different kind of relationship because there's a mutuality there. A boyfriend-girlfriend, well, or a boyfriend-boyfriend, girlfriend-girlfriend, whatever the configuration is, but romantic relationships and best friend relationships, for example, we're peers. It's not that one of us is the authority and the other is not, and therefore the nature of the relationship is different. And the interesting thing that goes on here in this mutuality is each of us is supporting the other, whereas with parent-child, it's usually the parent supporting the child. Here, I'm supporting my spouse, and my spouse is supporting me. So whereas I'm trying to create the conditions that allow my spouse to be both autonomous, to feel autonomous and to feel related, to get those needs satisfied, my spouse is also doing the same for me. And what the research shows is the highest quality relationships are the ones in which each of the two partners is supportive of the other in those kinds of ways, paying attention to what it is that the other needs.
I just wanted to mention, before the show, we talked about research that I've mentioned in my column by Brooke C. Feeney, and it's on something called the dependency paradox. And this is so fascinating. And basically, the finding is that people who feel their partner is responsive to their needs when they need comforting or love, that those people are more likely to be independent. So, and I had given advice to somebody who had a partner who was very clingy and needy, that maybe what he needed to do was actually to be more loving to her, show affection, tell her he cared, and that maybe she would ease up on pressing him for so much affection. I think that's such a fascinating finding.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, and it's a source of some confusion in relation to the work that we do. The term autonomy, which for us means doing something with this sense of volition, willingness, and choice, gets interpreted by some others as meaning independence, of doing it yourself, the rugged individualist. I'm going to go this on my own. That's not what we mean by autonomy. And when we're advocating autonomy and the importance of autonomy, that's not what we're advocating. Now, it's fine to be independent sometimes, yes, and you can be autonomously independent. You can make a deep, true choice for yourself that independence with respect to this activity is what I want for myself now. But you can just as easily be autonomously dependent. I hope that everyone who's listening has at least one relationship in his or her life where you feel quite deeply and truly and autonomously dependent on another. Maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's a romantic relationship, maybe it's a best friend, whatever it is, but it's a sense of dependence is what allows us in a deep way to be satisfying our need for relatedness.
I just want to repeat what you were talking about, autonomous dependence, because it sounds like sort of a paradox, but this is so important.
Yeah, but it's not at all. It just means fully and willingly depend on my partner.
Right, you choose to depend on
partner fully, willingly depends on me. what a wonderful relationship that you're each in a completely free kind of way, depending on the other.
Yeah, and that's different than being needy. That's very
right.
different than being needy. And so, and I think that that's very important to point out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the word dependence sometimes gets interpreted to mean needy, like I'm clutching and grabbing all the time. No, that's got to do with some inner need that hasn't been satisfied. This sense of neediness comes from having had a lot of experiences in your life of rejection and of people being cold toward you, and so that gets you to the place of wanting to grab on and hold on to being needy. No, dependence and needy are not the same thing. Needy is something that's an unpleasant kind of state that's come from having your needs frustrated in the past. And what we need in that situation is to be working with that person to get him or her to the place of feeling more cared about so that they don't need to be so so needy and clutching.
The word I like to use is interdependence, because dependence, as you say, dependence gets a bum rap in our society.
Sure.
So interdependence suggests two strong people coming together to sometimes rely on each other for certain things, but not that they're two shells of people, you know, two gaping holes that, you know,
right.
can't be filled. I think that that's,
that's
really
a
important.
Great word.
Thank you. You talk about one thing that you talk about in your book, and I should do a little station ID. I'm talking with Dr. Edward L. Deci. His book is Why We Do What We Do, Understanding Self-Motivation. And a lot of this book is based on his research with his longtime collaborator, psychologist Richard Ryan. Just we're giving everyone credit. And his co-author is Richard Flass. And it's a wonderfully written book. I wanted to talk a little bit about goals. When you set goals, you know, whether it's in a relationship or work, that they need to be individualized. And this is something that we don't do in schools. You know, I was a smart kid and I read really well and I didn't really like math. And it would have been good if somebody individualized my education, but they didn't. And talk about this, you know, it's the antithesis of the way we run schools, but also it's the antithesis of the way we run workplaces and a lot of things in our lives.
Yeah, that's true. And so there are two sides to this, of course, which is there are smart, educated adults who understand that there's certain kinds of things that are important for all kids to learn. I mean, you may not like math, but at least some knowledge of math is important to function effectively in the world. So on the one hand, we want to individualize things to give you the opportunity to learn things that you're interested in, but we also need to pay attention to the fact that there's some things that are important for you to learn, whether you find them interesting or not. And that's where the issue of internalization comes in. So we facilitate you internalizing the willingness to do things that you don't find interesting. But yes, we need to the extent that we can, be aware of what the interests of the students are and also what their skills are. And what we don't see enough in classes is the recognition by teachers that students have different levels of skills with respect to things. And what happens is that teachers get in the place of expecting all the students to do the same things. So they give them the same tasks and the same level of difficulty and so on, where in fact, if they would do some individualization, it would be much better for the students. Now, I don't mean to be picking on teachers. Lots of times teachers have too many students in their class to deal with, and they have students who aren't getting their needs satisfied at home, and so they come into school and raise a ruckus in school and so on. So I don't say that in an attempt to be critical at all, only to say that to the extent that it's possible and that teachers are in a place where they're supported enough that they can do this, that it's useful for them to be able to treat each child as an individual, each student as an individual, and to support them in the things that interest them, and then work with them to develop willingness to do some of the things that don't interest them but are important for them.
Well, for example, with math, I had to remedially study stats and all these things that I sort of glossed over in school and was allowed to gloss over and still managed to get good grades because I need them to read science and to be able to assess whether studies are good or not. And if somebody had told me all I needed to know, which I actually told my young friend Oliver, who's my friend's son, that they are not making him do math in school to be mean to him, that he would need this, that this would help him. He might be a director of movies or something, that you need to be able to know percentages and algebra and all sorts of things to just function in the world and to not be an idiot who's at other people's mercy. You know, if you go look at the rate on your IRA or something like that. And that was what someone needed to tell me. I needed to have a reason why. I mean, it's sometimes that simple for motivation, and we really make a mistake, you know, along with that. And I just wanted to have you, because we're almost out of time, just to emphasize how damaging it is. And people just, they don't believe this, but they can read your book, Why We Do What We Do, to find out more about this, that these external rewards, working for a grade or working for the first prize, instead of for internal motivations that we want to be competent, we want to love what we do, that those external rewards actually are work in contrary ways to our motivation.
Right. Yep. And economists don't like to hear that because they're very interested in incentives, incentivizing things. But in fact, it's the case that incentives can get people to do things, but they also can have some negative psychological consequences in the process. And so really what we're here to do is to support people, our patients, our students, whoever it happens to be, we're here to support them, to try and let them find what's right for them in their life, support them to take responsibility for themselves and do things that are meaningful for them at the same time that they're being mindful of what's important for other people around them, so that they can come to a place of being part of harmonious relationships that exist within collectives, whether the collective is a family or a school or a nation or a world.
Well, we are almost out of time. I wanted to ask if you have any final words of wisdom to leave us with on motivation.
Well, really, to me, it always comes down to when we're talking about motivation for ourselves, it's all about being willing to look within ourselves and ask ourselves the deep questions and be willing to answer them in honest ways. Are you willing to be honest with yourself about what's really meaningful and important for you as a person, and then to act in the world in a way that's congruent with what's deeply meaningful for you? And are you willing to relate to other people, whether they're your children or whoever those others are, in a way that supports them for finding what's really meaningful and true for themselves? If we can each be supporting others in that kind of way, we have the opportunity for us to be existing in collectives and relating to others in a meaningful way and to be acting responsibly toward those others and toward the collective and toward ourselves.
Thank you so much, Edward. I have been talking with Edward LDC. He is psychologist and co-author with Richard Flast of Why We Do What We Do, a book based on DC's research collaborations with psychologist Richard Ryan. Thank you. This is such a fascinating show. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure, Amy.